In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking with someone who is widely regarded as one of this country's leading authorities on children and the law. His name is Martin Guggenheim, and he's professor of clinical law at New York University. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you'll find in a book that he's written. The title is What's Wrong with Children's Rights? It is published by the Harvard University Press. And the book takes a look in part at the history of the children's rights movement, a movement that began in the 1960s and clearly was designed to protect children from harm. The major question that the book asks is, has the children's rights movement been a success? And our guest, Martin Guggenheim, says the answer might not be the one that we would hope for. He argues that, in fact, often the interests of children have not always come first, and there have, in fact, been cases where adults have had more to gain and indeed have gained more than the children that they claim to represent. As we talk this morning with our guest, Martin Guggenheim, questions, of course, are welcome. We always welcome conversation, debate, questions, comments. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that you try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and getting as many different callers as possible, certainly all the people who want to be involved. It's very easy. All you have to do is dial us up here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Good around Illinois and Indiana, where you may be listening if it's a long-distance call for you. And, of course, even people listening on the Internet around the United States also may use the toll-free. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Guggenheim, hello.
Yes. Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I would like to ask you maybe to talk a little bit personally in the beginning of our conversation, as you do in the preface to the book, about the history of your involvement in these issues, where you write about the fact that certainly you'd been working in the area of children's rights for a long time and had certainly been an advocate for children's rights, and that at one point, however, you felt that perhaps you might be at odds with some of the other people who would have said that they were doing the same thing.
Yes, that's exactly what my experience was. I found that I ended up rather quickly having the deepest arguments about what are not just our goals, which is quite common in any civil rights movement where advocates are arguing over strategy, but we were arguing over outcomes, over what results we wanted, and that helped me realize that the children's rights movement is unique among movements that were part of or that gave birth in the 60s, the civil rights movement being, you know, obviously hugely important, the feminist movement, in that the constituency plays no role in what we're doing. This is a movement of adults. It's a movement by adults, and I even want to suggest it's for adults in some ways, because we're using children so often for results that, you know, are going to have an impact on society, but it's our society, the adult society. And so these arguments I had with colleagues helped me realize that this is a strange movement. This is a different movement from others.
And to be clear now, for people who are listening, you also explained that under the very large umbrella of children's rights, there broadly are two areas one might deal with. One would be the relationship between or relative rights of standings of children and the state. That's something else. That's not really what you're focusing on here. What you're focusing on has much more to do with how do we balance competing claims about rights of parents and children, or parents and the people who represent them, and children and the people who say that they are representing them.
Yes, that is exactly correct. Blending the two discussions, what rights children should have when they are accused of crime, when they're going to be suspended from school, and the like, rights against the state, with the subject of what rights should children have within the family, is tricky and treacherous. Separating them, you can have two very important separate conversations. The book doesn't attempt to blend the two. that's a hard task. But the book focuses largely on rights within the family. And what I came to appreciate, the book is partly a reflection on my 30-plus years in the field having started just around the time I graduated law school, so I began working in it at its beginnings. The reflection on the field led me to appreciate that, or to conclude, that one of the enduring characteristics of the movement has been to become increasingly anti-parent. Mm. That is, in focusing on children as having rights within the family, it has led to policy practices and arguments that suggest that parents frequently are bad for their own children. And I think that's, of course, though sometimes true, not just an exaggeration, but deeply problematic.
Well, perhaps we ought to talk about, or I can give you an opportunity to talk about, how it is we got to the point where we actually started talking about children's rights within the family. Because it would have been true, there would have been a time not all that long ago, in fact, I'm sure people who will continue to make the argument today, who would say that within the family, it is the parent or parents, it is for them to decide what rights their children have. And this idea that somehow that the government should have some role in deciding what children's rights were. There would have been a time when it would have been strongly argued that it's none of the government's business. How did we get to the point where we started to feel as a society that there was some sort of societal interest in involving ourselves in family dynamics to the point that we would enter into a home and say to a parent, we feel that you're making serious mistakes here. You're abusing your children. You're unfit. And we might even go to the point where we would say, and we think that society think that it's in the best interest of this child to actually be removed from this home. I mean, how did we get to that point?
Well, we got to that point slowly, but I think for good reason. That is, the general principle that you just described is, I think, a sound one, that a society should have rules that provide for government to protect vulnerable family members from harm inflicted upon them within the family. We began with the idea that the family was metaphorically a zone of privacy that couldn't be penetrated by state officials, but when we talked that way, we were talking about men in a patriarchal society really owning their children and their wives, and that husbands and fathers had full power even to beat their wives. So part of this movement came out of the feminist movement that said, look, these rules were made by men and for men, and the vulnerable members of the family were the losers. Piercing legal fictions such as unity within the family and allowing one family member to sue another, even something called the intra-family tort immunity, was a major victory in 20th century law, allowing one family member to go to court and say, this person did something wrong to me, required changing Anglo-American law that once said, we don't divide the family that way. There aren't individual members. The family is a single unit. So that then led to the medical discovery of the battered child syndrome contributed to the idea that we came to appreciate that children can be seriously injured by parents, led to laws that for child abuse and protection. My point in the book, though, is that not that that's a mistake as a first step, but that the children's rights movement has helped take that very, very far. And so far that today it is common for most Americans to think that the greatest risk to children's well-being is being exposed to child abuse in their own home. And that is anything but accurate. The children's rights movement has been used by some in society to contribute to an understanding that what's wrong with American policy today is that we let parents have too much freedom to raise their children. So that's the bottom line, in a way, to the beginning inquiry of why should the state play some role? It should play some role, and the question is how much role in helping to rear children.
I know that there are people who would, as you do, place the development of the idea of children's rights within this larger context of the of an expansion of the idea of rights since the 1960s, and would make the kind of parallels that, that you have between, say, the women's rights movement, between the civil rights movement, between increasing concerns about domestic violence and so forth. Now, I think, though, also some people be prepared to argue that that children, however, are special, that they somehow have a special status, that they are different from adults. They are not always able to speak for themselves, take care of themselves, advocate for their own interest. And so for that reason, we have a special interest, that is, society does, in looking out for their interests because they often cannot do that for themselves.
That's exactly right, and going even further, and we wouldn't want them to be looking out for themselves in addition. And so that then becomes a clash within the children's rights movement. Some who are liberationists who argue for children to be entitled to have the same rights as adults, which means the right of self-definition of autonomy, is seen by others in the movement as nonsense, at least when we're talking about children below a certain age, whether that's 10 or 5 or 15, depending on who's saying it. So that within the movement, there's a question of rights to decide what life to live and rights to protection. But most agree, all agree with what you just said, that children certainly should have the right to be protected from harm. The hard question becomes, how much power should we give state officials in pursuit of the exercise of that goal? And what we have accomplished, the children's rights movement has accomplished in the past 40 years, is the greatest transference of authority over the lives of children from parents to state officials and judges than at any time in American history. And the question I'm asking is that good for children? Are we really improving their lives when we have, to the extent we have today, placed their fate in the hands of distant bureaucrats responsible for child-rearing decisions?
Well, that's here's a good opportunity for me to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Martin Guggenheim. He's professor of clinical law at New York University and is one of the leading experts in the United States on children and the law. His book, if you'd like to read it, that deals with this area in greater depth, is titled What's Wrong with Children's Rights? It's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The basic argument that you're making here is that we have indeed, in the pursuit of children's rights, and in the sincere and well-intentioned attempt to protect their rights, that perhaps we have gone too far, and in our effort to balance, and maybe rights is not always the best word, to balance the interests of the welfare of parents and children, that we've gone too far on the one side and maybe we've erred on the side of children and their interest. Can you just to give an example, give me a case study that would make the point?
Well, before giving you the case study, let me just add that one of the things I think that has gone awry in the children's rights movement is that it is over-concentrated on the notion of rights and leaving out needs and interests as something that's perhaps somewhere within the movement, but not at its center. At its center is rights. Now, the reason for that is that lawyers are leading this movement. This is a movement dominated by lawyers. In sharp contrast, the children's rights movement in the early 20th century was led by social workers, educators, you know, John Dewey, Jane Addams, non-lawyers who were interested in helping society reform itself to be more sensible in taking into account what children need and deserve. So the example I'll use is foster care and child protection. We have one of the highest rates in the world of out-of-home care, of children who are living in, other than their birth families' homes or adoptive homes, as a result of a court order barring them from living with their parents. Now, that could be seen as the epitome of a child-loving society that ensures that won't allow children to be raised by bad parents. But experts who have studied child protection recognize that the overwhelming reason most children are ordered not to live with their parents is because of the inadequacy of a support system in the United States that has nothing to do with abuse or bad parenting, but has to do with conditions associated with poverty. We have the highest rate of poor children of any nation that we like to compare ourselves with. We have the highest rate of children who are not given medical care, dental care of any nation we like to associate ourselves with, but we have the highest number of lawyers that we give children. And that's what the children's rights movement has accomplished. It gives kids lawyers and rights, but it doesn't give them the human rights to services, because in our country, our rights are negative. They're not positive. We have a right to prevent something, but we don't have a right to income or to services. So the children's rights movement doesn't deal very well with the realities of American politics. It's focused on courts and on lawyers, and they have not been very successful in trying to reshape our understanding of what families that don't have a lot of money need and deserve. What they need and deserve, American courts are not going to give them. So if the children's rights movement weren't dominated by lawyers, it wouldn't be thinking about going to courts as the main forum for improving the lives of children. I'd rather Jane Addams and John Dewey were still running the movement.
We have several callers here. Let's start to bring them into the conversation. We'll start with someone here on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for your topic. I think it's a very under-discussed one, and I'm glad you're taking a societal approach. I just, as someone who has worked in child welfare in a domestic violence shelter, I think one of the issues besides the lack of support for people who have low incomes is the lack of support for children in the system. Here in Illinois, for example, if you are placed in the foster care of a family member, you often don't get the money that is awarded to foster families who are not family members. But the concern I have as a former child welfare worker is very often children are not protected, even in, say, a county like Champaign County, which is under investigation for overaction at seizing children. There are still plenty of children who are being beaten on a daily basis by their parents. And so while I laud the reform of child welfare, I have to say I still think that not enough children are being protected. So, but I like your point of view, and I'll listen. So thank you.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that?
Well, I want to agree. I am not an either-or person here. I'm not saying that we don't need to protect children, and when there's evidence we don't do it enough, that we need to do better. But the rest of my remarks still stand.
All right, let's take another call. This next listener is in Ottawa, Illinois, line number four. Hello.
So, I have two questions. The first one, is my understanding correct in that CPS actually receives more government funding for the more children they take away from their parents? Is that
yes,
true?
It's an uncapped entitlement.
So if you confiscate 1,000 children rather than 900, you will receive a further 10% of funding for your agency?
Yes.
Oh, boy. My second question is, this rights-based theory that we seem to be moving on with in our society, where, correctly, we went from freeing the slaves to women's liberation, Now we're moving on to inanimate objects such as the world or forests, which are animate but are not conscious, or animal rights, or children's rights who really aren't able to speak for themselves. And here we have now another category of advocates who are demanding funds, demanding hearing from the people, and for more money for themselves. When in reality, is everyone cares about children in the forest. But these people take it upon themselves to speak for the forests and their children and the animals, the bald eagles. I'm wondering where this is going.
Well, I think there are real parallels with the other examples, the principal one being, as I said earlier, that the advocates in the movement, whatever it is, environment, animal, children's rights, are not the objects or the subjects of the movement, but right. Yet they don't have a constituency.
Frederick Douglass could speak for himself.
Exactly so, and I'm not a child.
The forest can't, but so these people claim to speak for the forest.
Yeah, but I mean, having said that, we still have to get deeper, right? We still then have to say that by it, that's an important insight, but that doesn't condemn something. It just means we have to address the subject with a little more delicacy. We have to realize that the advocate might have her own agenda that is being masked by claiming to be interested in something else.
I agree with you 100%. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, I think we have to be careful not to cloud the issue by bringing in related but indirect sort of points. I guess I still find myself going back to the idea that children, there are cases where protection is required. And that there are people who, for example, might feel that physical violence was an appropriate way to discipline their children. And if we as a society feel that that is not appropriate, then we need to have some way to deal with that. And if we get to the point where we think for the protection of those children they should be removed, we'd hope temporarily from their family, then don't we need to have some way to do that?
Absolutely, we do. One of the great victories of the progressive movement, which was really the first children's rights movement, was gaining societal consensus that government has a duty to protect most vulnerable citizens. And that included, for example, child labor laws, a great fight of social importance in the 20th century, with some arguing it's none of the state's business. It's a parent's right to permit her child to be gainfully employed at the age of 11. And our society ended up answering that great debate on the side of saying, no, society has a right, it is right for society, I mean, to place restrictions on that kind of freedom. As I say, that was a great victory. I'm not trying to turn the clock back and suggest that the government should not pay attention to protecting children who can't protect themselves when they are at risk of harm from their parents. The problem I have with the children's rights movement as it is currently operating in our culture is that it is a narrow, lawyer-driven movement that looks to the courts for help. And you know what courts end up doing? They end up giving judges more power to control family lives when the best answer for child welfare in the United States has to come in the legislature. It has to come in a recommitment to our society to redistribute wealth, to reduce poverty, and to make it easier through family leaves and most importantly, health insurance and dental insurance. Make it easier for parents to raise their children safely and well. But what has happened is when you make the point that we need to protect children from harm, I'm not going to argue with you. We do need to. But what has happened is that we have allowed a myth to bloom in the past 20 years, the myth being that the worst danger children experience in America is being abused by their parents. That is false.
Let's take another call. This is Bloomington, Indiana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. you know, for a movement, the Child's Protective Movement, sponsored by lawyers, this child's rights movement is especially disgraceful because it violates basic constitutional rights. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in virtually every state, child protective agencies can take children from parents on the basis of anonymous informers. So the parents may have their child taken from them, and the state refuses to tell them who their accuser is. Now for a movement sponsored by lawyers, that violates the Sixth Amendment. We have a basic right to know who the witness is against us and be able to cross-examine him. That's basic.
Well, you don't exactly state the facts. There is a policy that permits anonymous calls for investigative purposes, but children can't be removed without the investigator making an in fact assessment that a child is at serious risk of harm. It can't be. The anonymous call is the basis for the investigation, but it is not the basis for the removal.
I have heard some cases in which children have been removed, and the people who were supposed to be, I suppose, as you would say, the investigator, simply arrived at their door, demanded to see their children. Of course, now those parents, if they'd known their constitutional rights, they would have known that they did not have to let those government people in their house.
That's true.
But sometimes they don't know their rights, and they simply take the child on the basis. Quite often, it's the basis of the parents' religious belief, simply on the basis of the fact that the parents may be a fundamentalist Christian, or conservative, or may spank the child, and the child is taken from them.
There are lots of problems in enforcing the child welfare system. I certainly agree that it is not uncommon for children to be removed wrongfully, and that the courts don't always work well in correcting those mistakes. But I don't blame that on the children's rights movement. That is, the idea that we're going to want a mechanism by which we assign caseworkers to investigate allegations of child abuse, that does make sense to me. Your criticism is of how it's being enforced, and that's an important criticism, but the concept is something I think a just society would support. My bigger concern is not only with how we enforce this practice, but that it's the only thing we're talking about. We are only talking about parent abuse of children when in the United States it permits politicians to get away with doing too little to improve the lives of children. You ask a governor of a state, how are you demonstrating your concern for children? And they'll say, we have aggressive investigation of child abuse. And they get away with that as being a sufficient answer when it shouldn't be.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. And again, I should introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Martin Guggenheim. He's professor of clinical law at New York University. And he's one of the leading experts in the United States on children and the law. If you're interested in reading more on the subject, he's authored a book. It's titled What's Wrong with Children's Rights? The book is published by the Harvard University Press. Should be out there in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Again, we'll go on to another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, I guess I would like to bring a couple of points into this conversation. First, I mean, in spite of the illustrious history of the early children's rights movement like Jane Addams and John Dewey and so forth, I think, you know, my understanding is that until labor unions saw child labor as a threat to the wages of working men, not much was done about child labor. I mean, it was primarily economic motives, and certainly understandable economic motives, but not, you know, until there was an economic reason to exclude children from the labor force, it was not done. And until it was just seen as not an efficient utilization of labor, it was not done.
You're exactly right.
And I guess the other more complicated issue, in terms of, you know, there's a lot of apples and oranges, it seems, sort of underneath this conversation about child molestation and the interference of the child caring professions and so forth. And, you know, in following the controversial daycare cases over the past 20 years, starting with the McMartin case and going through North Carolina and up to the Northeast and then into the capturing the Freedmans and all this business, you know, this isn't really about children's rights. I mean, who are these people? Who are these police officers, district attorneys, some social workers who have participated in this kind of witch hunt mentality? What does that, are you saying that this, is this part of the children's rights, what you call the children's rights movements that you're critical of, or is this just a separate topic?
You know, it's a wonderful set of questions. I do see this as part of it. That is, at least as being, if this metaphor is acceptable, or analogy, bedfellows. The children's rights movement has contributed to the McMartin prosecutions because it's allowed us to focus on ways that we can protect children, and the children's rights movement has helped that along. But you're exactly right. Those are serving other agendas in the name of children. And the complication here is that it's not serving children. It's hurting children. And yet we go to bed at night feeling better about the ways in which we're doing well in our society for children. What we did in the process was frighten parents from putting their kids in daycare centers. You know, what's that all about? You know, we want parents to, we have a culture in which you can't do well anymore with a single income earner in a two-parent home, and yet we don't find easy ways to solve that riddle. It's your problem. We are a private society. We don't tell you how to live your life. But, you know, the minute something goes wrong, you're the bad parent. And it's very complicated. And instead of tackling these problems, we look for crises of the sort that you've mentioned.
But certainly you wouldn't confuse someone like Marion Wright Edelman and the Children's Defense Fund with the kind of mentality that's been prosecuting these daycare and parent molestation cases.
No, Marion Wright Edelman's work is the kind of work that, frankly, I think reminds me more of the progressive work. That is, she's focused on how to get legislatures to be more generous with respect to matters of children and their needs.
And what about those who are working for universal health care for children and so on and so forth? I mean,
that's exactly.
But still, so who is it you're focusing on here? I mean, what are there institutions? Are there professional organizations? Are you
the American Bar Association? The You go look on websites for children's rights organizations, and what you'll find are law offices throughout the country, 150 of them. Yeah. And their principal focus is protecting children from their parents and going to court to sue over, you know, things around that. What it's done, you see people, I'm really focused as a lawyer and a law professor on the legal profession. It's a narrow but very, very large part, focus of the children's rights movement.
And is this a self-generating movement? I mean, in other words, are they proactive? Do they have an agenda? Do they have a program? Are they simply responding to cases that come to court? Or, I mean, how does all this work?
Well, it's complicated, a little of both, but what I've found over the past 25 years is as I meet new students coming to law school, in high school and college today, the word is out there that there's a great field of children's rights in law. And I think what we've done is we've drained some progressive folks from other fields and sent them into law to advance children's rights. And law has done very, very little to accomplish that over the past 40 years.
So you think it's primarily negative, not just a kind of mixed bag in terms of what's been accomplished?
Well, it is a mixed bag. An earlier caller talked about the degree to which children are harmed when they're in state-supervised care arrangements. I think it's a good thing that we have some lawyers addressing that problem. In other words, I would not be happy to know that when kids are state wards, no one's worried about the harm that they're exposed to. They often don't get adequate health care. They often don't get proper education, not to mention that they are sometimes sexually and physically abused. But that's odd. We've spawned the children's rights movement contributed to 500,000 kids being in foster care, and now we need a children's rights movement to monitor the state wards. Okay, that's a complicated story, but it's still not getting at the question, why are 500,000 children in foster care in the United States, the land of the free and the wealthy? It's because we're allowing that to happen as a culture. And the children's rights movement is doing very, very little to address that problem.
So are you advocating fundamental changes in the nature of our social class system, our occupational system, our educational system that provide a basic level of income for families, that provide the kind of support systems that would be necessary for families and especially single parents to to maintain their children in adequate circumstances? I mean, do you see a fundamental class-based analysis here?
I'm happy to have this conversation and to talk about what we should do, but that's not the primary focus of this book and my work today, which is instead to suggest that those are the right questions to be asking instead of the questions we're now asking, which is what rights should children have, when should they have lawyers, when they go to court, and the like. What we've done in the United States is refuse to emulate Western European answers to supporting vulnerable families with free government services and a higher tax base. We've rejected those solutions. But then along came people who said, we don't care enough about children. And the American response has been, yes, we do. We'll charge their parents with unfitness when they aren't able on their own to care for their children. And we demonstrate our love for children by putting them in foster care.
Okay, thanks for your time.
Right. Well, it seems that we have made two basic points here. We've been talking in two areas. One, and the callers help illustrate the point, that there are lots of people pursuing a lot of agendas in the name of child welfare, when in fact child welfare may be secondary to what it is that they're actually trying to achieve, and that what we ought to do is do more than just give lip service to the idea of family well-being and actually give it more attention and more money. That's all well and good. But let's come back to the legal arena, which is, after all, your primary area of concern, at least in as far as the book is concerned. In what way, assuming that change will be glacial, in what way would you see it possible to at least change the way that we approach child welfare in the legal arena, perhaps than to give at least a little bit greater voice to the social workers, to the people who are aiming at representing the interests of the child through that avenue, and not simply make this a business of lawyers?
I'm I'm not sure I have an easy answer to that. I think that's a difficult nut to crack. We have to change the conversation. We have to challenge, you know, especially as we become a soundbite society that answers questions in less than 15 seconds. Talk to any American who's familiar with tabloid or talk television inquiry. What do we need to do more to protect children? And the answer is we've got to be more aggressive in our pursuit of child abuse in the home. I don't know. I don't have a terrific answer for how to change that perception. But experts know that's not the right answer. That's not the truth. That's not the case of what's wrong in America. But most bills passed in the state legislature and in the Congress that deal with children and child welfare in the past 30 years have been concerning foster care and removal of children from their parents' home. With the word child abuse and sex abuse widely used in this conversation. But health care, family leave, and all the other things that are less popular for election and whatnot are back burner issues, even though they play a much more dramatic role in child welfare.
Well, you've made the point a couple of times now in the conversation that people think, wrongly think, that the greatest threat to the well-being of America's children is that they would be abused by their parents. And while it is true that there are some parents who abuse their children, perhaps we, and I guess I start thinking about the way that media reports on and writes about families. Maybe we have done too many stories on child abuse, or the way that we have done them have we contributed to this belief that people have that that's the biggest problem we have, the biggest threat to kids is that they'll be abused by their parents?
Well, sure, I think so. Though I think the media will cover stories and make headlines over the death of a child at the hands of a parent, a statistically extremely rare event, but it stays in our mind. It's a horrible story, and we remember it well. But it tells us very little about the real problems of American family.
In this hour of Focus 580, again, let me introduce our guest. We have about 5-6 minutes left. We're talking with Martin Guggenheim. He's professor of clinical law at New York University and is recognized as an authority on law and children. He is the author of the book, What's Wrong with Children's Rights. It is published by the Harvard University Press. It is just out now. Questions and comments, of course, are welcome. Someone wants to call in real quick. I'm sure we can get one, possibly two, in the time that remains here in Champaign-Urbana. The number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line, again, good around Illinois and Indiana if it would be a long-distance call. And that number is 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, a couple of callers. We'll go to Champaign next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I apologize for not having heard the entire conversation. But the statement a moment ago, it sounded as if you were kind of downplaying the sexual abuse and whatnot in the home. And I listen to a show called Love Lines pretty frequently, and I'm always amazed at the sheer number of callers who admit to having been sexually abused, whether by their parents or a family friend or whatever. But it doesn't sound like that's not a major, major problem in this country. And it's not necessarily always their parents. It can be a neighbor or what have you. But it sure seems like there has to be some sort of epidemic given, I mean, it seemed like 50 to 75% of the people who call in have been sexually or physically or psychologically abused. And I was wondering if there wasn't a correlation between the fact that even if you have a high school diploma in this country, when you find these cases of these children being attacked or killed or what have you, these people don't have the basic education. You know, I mean, we're not talking about Rhodes Scholars here. So I guess I would just ask, do you think there's any kind of a relation between the breakdown of the American educational system to sort of prepare people to be adults and to be capable of raising children? Thank you. I'll just hang up and listen for your answer.
All right.
I'm afraid I can't answer that. I don't know. The self-reporting that you describe is as you describe it. I don't know what to make of it. I don't know if that means it's been going on for thousands of years or only the last 40, or I don't know. It's a hard question, and I don't want to pretend to answer something I don't know.
All right. Fair enough. Let's go to line two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I didn't hear the beginning of it, but I'm thinking this is in light of what happened with the Michael Jackson thing. Got a couple questions on that. Did they have to convict on all the accusations or on all the accusations that he had, or could they have done a few of the accusations or whatnot? And the other thing is, it seemed like the jurors based their judgment on the credibility of the witnesses, and how come, to me, I think those parents should be just as much trouble for putting them in a situation like that. I think the system needs to be looked at about how cases are presented, because those jurors, you know, went on the case of lack of reasonable doubt. And it's like, it seemed like they had some doubt, but they might have wanted to convict anyway.
Well, we have not been talking about criminal prosecutions. That raises a whole different set of inquiries. On the civil side, when parents are accused of sexually abusing their children or failing to protect their children, which could have been a charge brought against the parents of the boys in California for letting their children stay over Neverland or whatever, you don't have the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's only a preponderance of the evidence, the same amount of proof you need to win an automobile tort action for damages. It's much easier for the civil prosecutor to find a parent unfit than it is to convict somebody for criminal misbehavior. The consequences for civil prosecution of child abuse or neglect is that the state has the right to remove children from parents and even to terminate parental rights. That's another movement we didn't talk about in this hour, but one of the signal victories of the Congress in 1997 supported bipartisanly, with President Clinton leading the way, was to redirect American goals of child welfare from returning children to their parents as a primary first hope to becoming neutral and allowing adoption of children involuntarily by terminating parental rights as an equally appropriate result when children have been in foster care for more than 15 months. And as a consequence, we are a nation that is that involuntarily destroys parental rights and creates orphans by court order. We do that more than any country in the world. And that is seen as an example, a prominent example, of advancing children's rights. I question whether we should agree that that advances children's rights.
So, unfortunately, now we're going to have to, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. And my apologies, we have a couple of callers that we can't take. I guess I find myself feeling unsatisfied with where we end up, but I gather that you feel the same.
Well, I do, both because this is a complicated conversation that could continue, and because I don't have the answers, as I indicated to a substantive question earlier. So much as I think we need to work harder on finding those answers.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time this morning. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And our guest, again, is Martin Guggenheim. Guggenheim. He is professor of clinical law at New York University. He's leading authority on children and the law. And if you're interested in reading more on this subject, you can take a look at his book. It's titled What's Wrong with Children's Rights? It is published by the Harvard University Press.